So now we have Paula Stefan. Paula Stefan is a professor in economy from Georgia State University. And she has made a big contribution in explaining why risk is important in science. And she has analyzed how risk is less and less permitted by many committees and all agencies that provide the money for research, not only for the young scientists, because she has a huge involvement in promoting young researchers, but more and more, I mean, for the older people as well. It's really something which is just underscored, has just been underscored by Danielle, and we have to face this issue. I mean, if not, I mean, science will not progress anymore. So, Paola, thank you for coming. And it's your turn. Yeah.
So, thank you very much. And before I begin talking about risk and research, I want to say thank you to the Collège de France for the invitation to come and speak today. And then I want to apologize that malheureusement, or perhaps heureusement for you, I will be speaking in English and not in French. So by way of introduction, a basic tenet of economics is that the private sector underinvests in risky research if left to its own devices. Both spillovers and the time horizon required to recoup investments discourage the private sector from investing in basic research. We just heard that the average drug took 23 years from the time the research was done until it was on the market. It's a very long time horizon. And by spillovers, I mean that competitors in the market could gain from a firm's research if the firm did it, and that creates a disincentive for the firm to do it. Yet we know that risky research is absolutely essential for advancing the knowledge frontier. Hence, governments have a major role in supporting risky research with a higher variance and mean of outcome. It's not spot on each time. You can have a lot of failures, but you can have extreme successes. And this has been argued by a number of economists, and it was also argued in the report of Vannevar Bush, Science, the Endless Frontier. And in this situation, individuals working in the nonprofit sector are looked at as a source of risk-taking. Now, there are other reasons besides spillovers as to why the university sector plays a major role in basic research. Philippe Aguillon and his colleagues show that the practice of an academe of giving creative control to researchers encourages basic research, allowing academic researchers to be curiosity-driven. By way of contrast, in the private sector, decision rights belong to owners, managers, who direct or dictate the direction of the research. And this makes the private sector more attractive for applied research. Now, regardless of how you think about this, there's a strong tradition, at least since World War II, and indeed long before World War II, for government support for research in academe and public research organizations, PROs. Now, in spite of this, there's a perception among scientists and policymakers that the appetite for risk-taking among public funding agencies has declined or is absent, that rewards discourage risk-taking, and that these trends may be growing. So this is the week that the Nobel Prizes are awarded. So let me just quote James Rothman, what he said in an interview in 2013, the day after he shared the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. And on a radio interview, Rothman told the interviewer that, quote, He was grateful he started work in the early 1970s when the federal government was willing to take much bigger risk in handing out funding to young scientists. I had 5 years of failure, really, before I had the first initial sign of success. And I'd like to think that kind of support existed today, but I think there's less of it. And it's actually becoming a pressing national issue, if not an international issue. Now, if time permitted, I could give you quotes from many, many other scientists who are complaining or are indicating concern that the appetite for risk-taking has greatly declined. So this raises some questions. Do scientists working in the nonprofit sector engage in risky research? We certainly just saw a number of examples in which this is true. Does the public sector support risky research? If not, why? And the related question, is risk aversion on the part of funders and scientists increasing? These are very, very challenging questions to address. First of all, there's a huge measurement issue here. I mean, how do you measure risk associated with a piece of research that's been done, with a proposal that's come before a funding organization? That's extremely difficult. But it's even more difficult to think about measuring risk for things that never really see the light of day, because they either failed or someone cut off the funding for it or whatever. This is sometimes referred to as the file drawer problem, that we can't even observe it. And then I think it's important to realize that what we mean by risk varies depending upon one's role. Funding agencies arguably see risky research through the lens of volatility of outcomes, a lot like financial institutions do, that one thinks about that an investment portfolio can have a high variance and that there can be some real winners in it and possibly not some winners. And if you look at the European Research Council's motto, it's high risk, high gain. Review panels who make decisions regarding funding for scientific research, I believe, and I'm not alone here, arguably focus on the downside associated with research. They're much like insurance agencies. We buy insurance, or insurance agencies provide insurance against bad things happening. Review panels look at proposals, and in a sense, they want to get rid of proposals that they think will fail. And they focus less on the great potential in a proposal, I would argue. Now, researchers see their gain associated with risky research, but they also have career concerns regarding the consequences associated with failure, especially consequences in the short run. And I'll return to that theme in a few minutes. And they may put different weights on these than do funding organizations. So in the time remaining with me for me today, I really want to look at three topics. I want to look at how the rewards to science discourage risk-taking on the part of scientists. I want to present one measure of risk associated with research, and then I want to show you some research that I've done with Reinhilde Vulliger and Jean Wang concerning the extent to which the European Research Council funds individuals with a history of risk-taking based on this measure. So, let me begin by talking about how the rewards and structure of careers discourage risk-making. So, let me start by what I argue as the quadruple effect, discouraging risk-taking. So, this, when I say this, and I'll explain in just a minute, I mean that the rewards attached to risky research are not commensurate with the potential loss arising from failure. And I call it this because of In the last Winter Olympics, you may have noticed, or it was pointed out, that none of the women medal winners in figure skating attempted a quadruple jump, where you do four turns, but that all the men who won a medal attempted a quadruple jump, and they succeeded. So I was very interested when I listened to an interview of people familiar with the way in which figure skating is scored, and I have to say I'm not an expert here at all, but it was pointed out that the scoring is different between men and women. So that the score for the incremental score for a woman between a triple and a quadruple is not that great. So there's great risk that if one tries it and misses, you have no chance at a medal. And the increment to your score is not that great. But in scoring for men, there's a much larger distance between the score for a triple and a quadruple. And these commentators argued that that created this phenomena we saw. Well, this kind of quadruple effect, I think, can be seen to be present in science. So some very interesting work by sociologists at the University of Chicago and Northwestern University looked at new chemical combinations, and what Foster and his colleagues do is they examine the extent to which chemists introduce novel chemicals and chemical relationships using network analysis to study publications in Medline, which is biomedical publications. And what do they find? Well, they find that an innovative publication is more likely to achieve a high impact than a conservative one, but the additional award does not compensate for the risk of failing to publish. It's very much like this quadruple effect. And this is consistent with the concept that a traditional path is a reliable course for accumulating recognition, and that the rewards can discourage risk-taking that leads to innovation. The authors also find a growing focus on established knowledge using new chemical combinations, and that's consistent with the idea that risk-taking is declining over time. Now, there's other work that's quite consistent with this. Brian Uzi and colleagues look at the references in articles, and from these references in articles, they look at whether it's a likely combination of references or an unlikely combination, with the idea that if you're doing research and you're drawing all of your ideas from unlikely sources, it's riskier. And they find that the publications that do the best in citations draw from conventional wisdom. They're using conventional predictable sources with just a wee bit of novel research thrown in. It's rather consistent with this. I should say that if you hear Evans talk about this, he likes to show this picture that he says he thinks the rewards really encourage us to be in the traditional path and not out here and innovative in terms of doing risky research. I think it's also important to think about the fact that reputation can be compromised by proposing risky research, and this can discourage scientists from taking on risky research. And I like to think of this as the ice cube effect. So many of you may know that Ice Cube is a neutrino observatory constructed in Antarctica. It has sensors, domes that are distributed over a cubic kilometer to a depth of 1,450 meters to 2,450 meters. And each one of these domes has 60 light detectors. Now, Ice Cube was really the brainchild of Francis Helzon. Francis Helzon is a Belgian astrophysicist, astronomer, who has spent most of his career at the University of Wisconsin. And if you hear Francis Elzon talk about Ice Cube, he will say that he had had this idea for a number of years, and that approximately 40 years ago, he really began to think about the possibility of a neutrino observatory in the ice. But he was very concerned about how such a crazy idea might affect his reputation. So he said he thought about it, and an invitation came to him to speak at a fairly obscure or not well-known conference in Eastern Europe. This is long before the internet and before the wall fell. And he told me in a conversation that, you know, I thought, if I don't talk about it here, where can I talk about it? That I'm pretty insulated from reputational effects here. And he was extremely encouraged by the enthusiasm. He went back home and began thinking about writing proposal to get funding for Ice Cube. Ice Cube is now an international consortium. But I think it's important to realize that 40 years ago, Halzon did not need to be concerned that the community would know immediately of what he'd said. But today, information spreads almost instantly. And if these reputational effects discourage risk-taking, that can create an issue. And perhaps this is more relevant for the United States than elsewhere, there's what I would call the funding or famine effect to discourage risk-taking. So an increasing proportion of research scientists in nonprofit sector work in what are called soft money positions in some countries. So a soft money position means that you are given a position, you're given a lab, but you're not given a salary guarantee with the position. The only salary you're going to get is if you bring in a grant, and you can charge your salary off of the grant. So this means, to use the words of Stephen Quake, who's a biophysicist at Stanford University, that for these people, funding or famine has become their mantra. They absolutely have to have funding to do research. And this discourages engaging in research with a significant probability of failure, or for which rewards can take a long time to be realized. It really limits the amount of creative control or curiosity-driven research that one can possibly do. And I think, at least from the United States, this is extremely important, because soft money positions have increased a great deal. NIH estimates that 50%, that's the National Institutes of Health, estimates that 50% of all of its funding goes to salary support. We do not know how many of that or how much of that is in soft money position, but a great part of it is in soft money position. In 35% of medical schools in the United States, tenure is accompanied by no financial guarantee of salary. So you get a letter that says you have a job for the rest of your career, but you don't have any salary attached to it, a strange concept of tenure. And then in 52%, tenure is accompanied by specific financial guarantee, but only in 13% is that really your entire salary. And if you look at the Harvard Medical School, and you look at people doing basic research there, only 140 of Harvard medical faculty are actually Harvard employees. The rest of them are hospital employees, and that means they're in soft money positions. Finally, I would argue that citation practices and the availability of citation data discourage risk-taking. So consider what Richard Catlow wrote. He's the Foreign Secretary of the Royal Society. He published this in Nature right after he became the Foreign Secretary. And he says, "I was lucky. When I began my scientific career in the 1970s, I had no real sense of how my work was cited. My discipline, computational materials chemistry, was barely acknowledged by mainstream chemists. If I had been citation-driven, I might have obtained a field I might have abandoned a field that is now central to developing sophisticated materials, including porous catalysts, electronic ceramics, and ionically conductive materials. By the 1990s, when citation data became prominent, I was already a full professor. More generally, I want to argue that short-term bibliometric measures can discourage risk-taking. And what I want to show you is consistent with research on novelty that I've done with Reinhold Vulliger of KU Leuven, Jean Wang of the University of Leiden, and myself. And in this work, and you saw just a brief preview of it yesterday when Professor Monchot talked about it, we show that novel research, which has properties associated with risk, takes longer to show bibliometric impact than non-novel research. So let me take a few minutes to talk to you about novelty as a measure of risk. So when I talk about novelty here as a measure of risk, this builds on a combinatorial view of knowledge creation. And in this combinatorial view, researchers work with pieces of knowledge and they combine them to generate new knowledge. And you can think about exploitation, you use knowledge pieces in well-understood ways, and in exploration, you use existing knowledge in new, novel ways. And it's generally agreed, and there's been considerable amount of work on this, that explorative research is more likely to lead to breakthroughs than exploitative research, but it has a higher risk of having impact in the sense that you get a much broader distribution of outcomes. So in the work we do, we create a measure of novelty based on the references in published papers. And we choose to look at papers published in 2001 because we want to look at what happens to them in terms of a citation history over time. So for each paper published in 2001, we retrieve all of the references, and we look from the references, we combine them in dual pairs to look at co-citation journal pairs. And we check to see if these two journals have ever been cited or paired together before in the last 20 years. We identify pairs, if any, that are novel. In other words, it's the first time they've been made. And then for each one of these, we compute how difficult it was to make the pair by looking at whether it had common friends in terms of other journals. And we sum these together to get a measure of novelty. So, in 2001, using data from the Web of Science, there were 661,000 unique publications. And when we use this technique, we find that of those, 89% had no new combinations. 1% at the very top had a large number of novel combinations, new combinations. And in between, there was a group that had a few novel combinations. So we refer to these as non-novel, moderately novel, and highly novel. So what do we find? Well, first of all, we find that the mean and the dispersion of citations are greater for highly novel than for non-novel. We find novel papers have more citations on average, but they also have a higher variance. And that's consistent with this measure having a riskier profile or being somewhat of a proxy for risk. This is just a model in which we estimate these two parameters simultaneously. So we find that highly novel papers have a higher mean and more dispersion. And we find that this is driven by both tails of the distribution, that if we compute the probability that these highly novel papers are at the top 10% of citations, the highly novel are more likely, the moderately novel are slightly more likely, but we also find, at least for highly novel, that they're more likely to be in the bottom, that they didn't pan out in terms of citations. And what we find to be, I think, the most interesting of our research is we find very, very delayed recognition that novel papers, these riskier papers, they're more likely to be top-cited. This is the probability that one is the top 1% cited paper, but it's in the long run. It takes time. This is time on this axis. This is this probability, and you see the non-novel papers, the probability doesn't change over time, but for the highly novel, it changes, but in the very early years, they're not recognized. We also look at the relationship between novel papers and what could be thought of as journal impact factor. So journal impact factor is a measure of how many citations per page a journal gets, and it's widely used as a measure of the influence of a journal. Currently, the journal Nature has the highest journal impact factor. So we run different kinds of models to look at the relationship of this novelty measure, or of highly novel and moderately novel, to journal impact factor, and we find a negative relationship. In other words, these highly novel papers are more likely to be published in low impact journals. We don't know whether that's because of selection, that the author doesn't send them to high impact factor journals, or whether they get rejected there and they end up later in these lower impact journals. But this is quite important because lots of decisions are based on journal impact and on citations. So our novelty findings suggest that short-term bibliometric measures discourage risk-taking. And yet such measures are used for hiring. They're used in third-year review, at least in the United States, where we decide whether somebody gets, we've hired somebody, we haven't given them tenure, are we going to allow them to stay for 3 more years before we make a tenure decision? Short-term bibliometric measures play a huge role here. They play a role in promotion, and they certainly play a role in funding decisions. I've sat on many panels, and I'm sure a number of you here have, in which panel members want to talk about the impact factor of the journals that people have published in. So, the final topic I want to talk about is whether funding agencies avoid risk-taking. And I want to give an example of the extent to which the European Research Council funds researchers with a history of novel research. So, as many of you may know, the European Research Council, the ERC, is a program within the EC which provides funding for basic research. It was set up in 2007. It's had over 60,000 applications to date, and it's funded 7,000 projects. It has a very sizable budget, and its motto, as I stated earlier, was high risk, high gain. Indeed, the mission statement says that scientific excellence is the sole selection criteria. In particular, high risk, high gain, pioneering proposals which go beyond the state of the art, address new and emerging fields of research, introduce unconventional, innovative approaches are encouraged. The ERC supports research in all fields of science and the humanities. It has 25 panels, and it gives funding to starting grants. Those are people who are newly out of a PhD program, people who've been out a little longer, and advanced, people who've been out at least 10 years. And it's for 5 years of funding. The selection process is that the Scientific Council of the ERC chooses members to be on panels to select who gets funded. And when panel members go to orientation, the ERC tells them, you know, our goal is high risk, high gain. As I said, panel members decide who gets the grant. There are 2 stages of review. In stage 1, People on the panel look at a 5-page summary of the research and at the applicant's CV. They then score them, they meet, they have a discussion, and they decide which proposals will go to stage two. And in stage two, a 15-page summary proposal, full proposal, is sent out to reviewers, external reviewers, external experts. Starters, people who are early in their career, are invited to come for an interview. And this all occurs in stage two, where decisions are made. So what we do in this very exploratory research is we use our novelty measure to investigate the extent to which the ERC supports researchers with a record of novel research. Our sample is everybody who's gotten funded and a large sample of people who did not get funded but who applied. And we estimate a probability of being selected at stage one and stage two. The explanatory variables that we're particularly interested in is whether the researcher has at least one novel paper in the pre-selection application stock of publications, and whether the researcher has been a top cited. And we control for a number of other important variables. So what do we find? Well, we find that applicants with a history of novel research are less likely to be supported. Being top-sided does not diminish this negative effect. Top-sided plays a positive role, but people who are both who have a history of novel research and are top-sided, that doesn't diminish the negative effect of being top-sided, of having done novel research. And these findings are for starters, for early career people. This is probably too finely grained for you to see, but what we find is that if you have high visibility in terms of citations, you do better. But if you have a history of novel research, you're less likely to get it. And this is for starters. And most of the effect comes when people are looking at these very short proposals, the abstract of the proposal, and studying the CV. We do not find this for advanced applicants, and I think our research is consistent with the idea that panelists focus on the possibility of failure among starters but not established researchers with track records, that risk is tolerated for accomplished researchers. So this work is somewhat consistent with some other work that's been done in other settings. For example, Wang Li and Walsh look at Japan, and they study the relationship of having done novel research to being funded either by internal block funds, in which you don't make an application, versus competitive funds. And they find no significant relationship between novelty and competitive funding among senior established researchers, but they find a strong negative relationship between novelty and competitive funding for junior Japanese faculty and for women regardless of seniority. Or here in France, Marianne Lehonneau, who has just defended her PhD at the University of Bordeaux, she studied grants at ANR, and she evaluated the relationship of risk-taking to getting funding. She looked at who applies and who is funded, and she uses a measure of novelty that's somewhat related to the measure that I just talked to you about. So what does she find? Well, she finds that people who have a history of doing novel research are more likely to apply, and she also finds that they're less likely to be funded. The panels are less likely to fund them. Finally, this work is consistent with work of Kevin Boudreau and co-authors. So this is a group of economists and people at the Harvard Medical School who've studied by running experiments at Harvard a number of issues related to funding in science. And they conduct one of these experiments they conducted at the Harvard Medical School, and they have 6-page proposals that are randomly assigned to reviewers All of the reviewers are faculty at the Harvard Medical School. And they examine the relationship between evaluations and novel departures from existing research paradigms and pathways. They measure novelty by examining medical subject heading terms and combinations of these in proposals. And they compare them to pairs in the entire existing literature that one can find in PubMed. And they compute the fraction of pairs that have not yet appeared. So what did they find? Well, they find a large negative relationship between the score the reviewer gives the proposal and the proposal's novelty. So again, this is consistent with a view that reviewers are biased against novelty, suggesting that reviewers are risk averse. So by way of summary, I hope I've convinced you that risk-taking in science is rare, that there's some evidence that it's decreasing, that the reward system and the structure of careers discourage risk-taking, that review panels avoid funding individuals with a history of risky research measured by novelty, especially for early career people. And it's consistent with the idea that panels, rather than looking at the upside associated with research, focus on ensuring that agencies avoid funding failed research. For a number of years, I was on the advisory council for the National Institutes of General Medicine, which is the basic research organization of the National Institutes of Health. And I'll never forget one proposal we looked at, and the scientists in the room kept saying, this would be great if it would work. But there's a possibility it won't work. And if it won't work, we don't want to fund it because we can't afford to have our name associated with a piece of research that fails. It's much like an insurance agency. So let me close by just briefly mentioning ways to encourage risk-taking from a funder's point of view. So I think it's very important to restructure the way in which funding is awarded and packaged. I think we definitely need grants of a longer duration. I mean, people, research does not always pan out. Research can fail. We need time for people to recoup and come back and do other types of research. And if you have a grant of 3 to 4 years, one simply cannot do that. There's not enough time. I think it's important. There's work done that looks at organizations such as the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. It doesn't ask people to give them a project. It tells them to present themselves as a candidate. I mean, do they do curiosity-driven research? What kind of ideas do they have? Fund people rather than a project. I also think we need more of funding for groups where risk can in many ways be pooled. We like to think that the Bell Labs, or we know that some of the great ideas, great breakthroughs came out of the Bell Labs. Well, at Bell Labs, it was the group that was supported. People weren't being evaluated one by one, but the group was being evaluated. And that really allows you to, in some sense, pool your risk and not be concerned one by one. And then I think it's very important to experiment with alternative review or decision strategies at foundations. I think it's absurd to require unanimity among reviewers. I mean, in a sense, that kind of drives it to perhaps the worst type of outcome. I'm very intrigued with the idea of what are called golden tickets that are used at some foundations. So a golden ticket is that every panel member has at least one right to fund one proposal that if nobody else agrees with your perspective, this proposal will still be funded. You don't have to convince everybody. We have a golden ticket. I think it's really important to remind panels that they're building a portfolio. When we invest as investors, we're not supposed to choose stocks one by one. We choose them in terms of what we already have and what we're bringing in, a portfolio. But yet, in these panels, proposals are looked at one by one, and in a sense, I think we end up with a portfolio that has virtually no risk in it. And then this is less related to the risk idea, but something I think that's become quite worth thinking about, and that is to consider at least funding some grants by lotteries. And what do I mean by this? I mean to consider the possibility that in proposal review for funding, we see some proposals that everybody agrees there's something really not workable here, and a few proposals that people think have great promise. But there's a large number somewhat in the middle, and a great deal of resources are spent thinking about those, writing those proposals. So there's the idea that at least part of the proposals, who gets the funding, be decided by lottery. And if you want to know more about this, you can go to the Volkswagen Foundation's website, because they started funding by lottery about 2 years ago, and the Swiss Foundation is experimenting with it. And so by disclosing, let me say that there are also ways, I think, to encourage risk-taking from the universities and public research organizations. I think it's absolutely essential that we place less emphasis on short-term bibliometrics in hiring and promotion. I think it really, really, really discourages risk-taking. I'm very enthusiastic about having resources locally available so people who have a very creative idea or think there's something that they want to work on don't need to write a proposal to a funding organization, but in a very short period of time, less than a week, can get their institution to provide them with resources to investigate this. Caltech has funds to do this, and it appears to have been extremely productive for them, that you write a three-page proposal, you turn it in, within 1 or 2 days, you find out whether you're going to get $100,000 to $150,000 to start working on it. And then something that I think is really damaging the kind of research we do is soft money positions. So with that, I'll end. Merci beaucoup. And this is my email address if you have questions.